Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories Project. Now, I've got some consultants in who are going to assess how this podcast is going. What do you reckon to the intro?
Well, that could have been worse.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honoured if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's all you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away by the title, really. I'm here to talk off the stories of films, and I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all those ingredients that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. Now, the movies I tend to cover on this podcast have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. Try really hard not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation of just how hard it is to get a movie made. That is my preamble introduction, though. So should we just get on with it? I cover two different films every episode. The first of which, well, let me play you a clip from the trailer. I'll come to the story the other side of this.
My dear Frodo, you asked me once if I had told you everything there was to know about my adventures. Well, I can honestly say I have told you the truth. I may not have told you all of it.
Bilbo Baggins, I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
I can't just go running off into the blue. I am a Baggins.
Wait!
Of Baggins.
Bilbo, allow me to introduce Feely, Keely, Oin, Loin, Darlin, Barlin,
Biffa, Wofa, Wompa,
Dory, Nori, Ori,
and the leader of our company,
Thorin Oakenshield.
Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep.
So this is a long overdue venture for this podcast to Middle Earth in The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, directed by Peter Jackson. Screenplay by Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, Peter Jackson and Guillermo del Toro, based on The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, and starring Ian McKellen, Martin Freeman, Sylvester McCoy, Richard Armitage, James Nesbitt, Ken Stock, Cate Blanchett, Ian Holm, Christopher Lee, Hugo Weaving, Elijah Wood, Andy Serkis, and quite a lot of orcs as well. And so the story of the Hobbit movie, well, we sort of need to go back a little bit. to when those core creatives of Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens and Peter Jackson delivered the Lord of the Rings trilogy to billions of dollars of revenue, to 11 Oscars for the final film in that particular series as well. And as the series wrapped up, it led to the inevitable question, what about a film of J.R.R. Tolkien's, perhaps his other hugely popular book, The Hobbit? Now, The Hobbit, a much slimmer book, still in Middle-earth, with characters roughly overlapping in some cases with Lord of the Rings. Well, that was a project that was being talked about an awful lot. So Jackson, coming off the back of Lord of the Rings, first of all, he wanted a rest and a bit of a sleep. So he had a rest and a bit of a sleep. And he was pursuing other projects for a little while, that he would make The Lovely Bones and his long-cherished film of King Kong, for instance. It's also worth noting that there have been plans to make a live-action film of The Hobbit before, back when Miramax controlled the rights to the book, and at that stage there was a pitch in place for a single movie. This was well ahead of when the Lord of the Rings trilogy came to life. But while all this was happening and Jackson was off exploring other projects, there was the small matter of ongoing disagreements between his team and New Line Cinema over profits from the Lord of the Rings films. And this was putting a significant spanner in the works of remounting everything to go and bring The Hobbit to the big screen. It got to the point where by 2007, Jackson was suing New Line Cinema, that he was contending that he had not received a fair and proper accounting of the first Lord of the Rings film's income, including DVD sales and foreign receipts. Now, those movie tickets alone accounted for $3 billion, and fans of the Middle-earth films will note that when they came to DVD, not only did they sell lots of DVDs the first time round, but extensive extended editions were also sold, and so the revenue kept pouring in, and Jackson and his team didn't feel they were getting a fair slice of it. So this was, there were tens of millions of dollars at stake, really, and this put a hold on The Hobbit. It got to the point where in September 2007, New Line was fined by a judge $125,000 for not producing the required potential evidence to defend itself in the case. But in the end, a settlement was reached by the end of 2007 that New Line and Jackson patched up their differences, started exchanging Christmas cards again, and this meant that The Hobbit could now go ahead. And I mean, from this point onwards, it was moving at reasonable speed as well. The announcement came in April of 2008 that The Hobbit film was a go. In fact, it was going to be two films. Now, Jackson himself had elected not to direct the new movies, and instead he'd brought in Guillermo del Toro, who at that stage was finishing up the second of his Hellboy movies. And he agreed to direct a pair of Hobbit films that would require him to up sticks from his home in America to go and live down in New Zealand for 4 years as part of his commitment to the project. This was as per a Los Angeles Times report that at the point he signed on the dotted line, he knew that he was going to have to relocate his family. And he knew that building up to making a Hobbit film was going to take a good year or two of just outright preparation. It's pretty well known that when the first Lord of the Rings trilogy came around, it was 2-3 years of building the film, of writing the film, of building the infrastructure in which to that could make the film before a single shot was in the can. And whilst there was a legacy left behind in New Zealand from Peter Jackson and the Lord of the Rings team, not least Weta Digital, his visual effects house, that meant they weren't having to start entirely from scratch, there was still going to be a lot of preparatory work required before they could get filming. Del Toro would need to work with the team at Weta. He would need to approve designs. They would need to work out just what this Hobbit film was. And so there was enthusiasm at this stage. It was going to be a joint production between New Line Cinema and MGM. So that was one thing, although the MGM bit would come to bite them in the backside a little bit. New Line and MGM were jointly going to put the money together. A 2011 release date was never announced, but that was the plan for the first of the Hobbit films, with 2012 being earmarked for the second. Weta would be back on board to make all the assets as well. Peter Jackson's Wingnut Films would be the production company partner. And Jackson made a very deliberate decision to step back a little from the process, that he didn't want to interfere with the way Guillermo del Toro wanted to make his take on The Hobbit. That it was almost in a godfathery role, really. However, this plan, as del Toro got underway, was soon to be scuppered, not for creative reasons, but for boardroom reasons. Because this was a point where where MGM was about to hit significant financial problems. And this was affecting a slate of films that it had, some of which it had made, some of which it was planning to make. So a remake of Red Dawn, for instance, was made and paid for, but MGM got to the point where it couldn't afford to release it. The 2012 James Bond film Spectre wasn't actually originally supposed to be out in 2012. It was supposed to be out earlier, but MGM didn't have the funds to pay for its part of the production budget. And with the bill for the Hobbit movies running for hundreds of millions of dollars per film, well, MGM just didn't have the cash. And New Line Cinema wasn't going to stump up MGM's side and not increase its slice of the cake. And so it all just kind of hit stasis a little bit. And Del Toro and his team were preparing the film but couldn't start filming. There was soon no chance at all of a 2011 release when it became clear just how deep MGM's financial problems were. This was a significant, significant spanner in the works. And it got to the point where Del Toro just had to stop waiting. He'd already moved his family. He'd made this massive commitment to go to another country for years of his time, and there was no sign that he would be able to start production on his films. They'd been doing lots of pre-production, they'd been doing lots of design work, they'd been building the film, but they couldn't make the film. And eventually Del Toro just needed to get a film made, and he would announce his departure in the autumn of 2010. Del Toro would fairly quickly move on to the film Pacific Rim because he'd just been off a movie set for so long and wanted to make movies, and The Hobbit clearly wasn't going to happen. Now, come the autumn of 2010, it was, who's going to replace him? So David Yates of the Harry Potter films was mentioned on one or two news sites as a possibility. But it was in October 2010, with MGM's financing problems sorted and restructured, that Peter Jackson realised he was going to have to direct the films. He was going to have to be the ones to get these over the line. Now, Del Toro had actually departed the films back in the May of 2010, and that was a catalyst of sorts for MGM to get its act together and to put the financing together. But there was no option really to delay, because MGM was going to have to put in such a substantive amount of money, it would need a return fairly quickly on that as well. And so while it was never utterly confirmed, that's why the foot was basically pressed on the accelerator, that there's likely to be a financial undercurrent to it. Now, Del Toro was quoted in The Independent just talking about how gutted he was that he had to walk away. He said, "I have a huge heartbreak. I have incredible sadness." He said, "I have disappointment, and a piece of me has been dented forever." And he still talks about it in interviews when he's promoting his subsequent films as well. And as he added to The Hollywood Reporter, "To relocate your entire family life home for a period that long without any certainty that it will get made or when it will get made, it starts to become very worrisome." So filming was due now to begin in February 2011, and Jackson now found himself in a race against time to prepare the films. And it was a race he'd concede he'd not entirely win, because first and foremost, he had to work through everything that Del Toro had overseen to that point. He'd deliberately been hands off. He'd tried to give the director of the films the space to make them. But the offshoot of that was when it became time that he was going to sit in the director's chair instead. He was almost starting, not quite square one, but not far off it. He went through things that Del Toro had discarded even. And he would recall about all those years he had to build Lord of the Rings. And now he had months to get to the complexity of the Hobbit shoot that was fast approaching. There were other issues as well, that at one stage, it was always assumed that the Hobbit films were going to be made in New Zealand, but at one stage they threatened, Warner Brothers, the parent company of New Line, was threatening to take the production elsewhere, when the local actors union in New Zealand found itself in conflict with the studio. That one side of the story was that the local actors union was seeking to unionise those who were working on the film and were meeting stiff resistance, or as The Guardian in the UK framed it, the dispute arose because of a union of performers sought to exercise its members' internationally recognised rights to collectively bargain. It was nothing more and nothing less. Now, what happened in the aftermath of that, depending which side of the argument, irrespective of which side of the argument you were, was the New Zealand government swung into action, because there's no way it wanted to lose having the Hobbit films shooting on its shores, that the Lord of the Rings movies and the sets that had stayed up for the Lord of the Rings movies had been a brought tourist boom to the country. And so it very, very quickly passed what was known as the Hobbit Law. Now, this was a law that blocked the unionisation of the New Zealand film industry. It sped through the New Zealand Parliament at double speed and stayed on the statute books for a long time as well, continuing to cause some degree of unrest via its due to its existence. Now, on the casting side, I mean, Jackson was able to inherit some of the casting decisions that Del Toro had made, and the one that they really agreed on was Martin Freeman in the role of Bilbo Baggins. Now, Freeman had risen to prominence in the TV show The Office, the British version, and he'd proven he could handle himself on the big screen in films such as Love Actually and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Now, he'd been filming the first series of the TV show Sherlock when he went along for his first round of auditions for The Hobbit. It was Del Toro who was casting at the time. Now, the two of them never met, but Del Toro had very long phone calls with Freeman and was happy to put him in the role. But the assorted delays caused by the MGM issues meant that when it was time to move on with The Hobbit, well, Freeman was now in demand because the TV series Sherlock had turned into an international sensation and he was committed to filming the second series of that show. So, with significant regret, he had to turn the role of Bilbo Baggins down. So Jackson had no choice. He went back to the audition tapes. He looked at dozens of auditions from some fairly high profile actors as well. But in the end realised, well, it's got to be Martin Freeman. He's right for the role. They'd made the right call. And so they restructured the way they shot the film so that they could accommodate Freeman's commitment to making the new Sherlock episodes. They built in breaks into the Hobbit schedule so that he could go from New Zealand back to London to make Sherlock. Now, there were lots of holdovers from Lord of the Rings and new additions to the ensemble as well. A very, very big a very, very big cast came together, including the delightful Sylvester McCoy, who'd missed out on appearing in Lord of the Rings. He got down to the final two for the role of Bilbo Baggins. He finally got his trip to Middle Earth, where he was cast in the role of Radagast. And the actors involved were all signing their deals for the two films that they were expecting to make. Finally, after years of legal problems, financial problems, in February 2011, the filming of The Hobbit could get underway, with the plan being to shoot both movies back to back, as had happened with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Now, it didn't get off to the best of starts because Jackson was rushed to hospital with a stomach ulcer that slowed things down for 3 to 4 weeks. And even from his hospital bed, he was having to oversee and approve design work. I mean, there really was no rest there. He was working from the script that he'd put together along with Philippa Boyens, along with Fran Walsh, and also Del Toro had contributed to it as well. But they were never entirely comfortable with where it was. I mean, that said, the infrastructure was still in place from their previous experience shooting Lord of the Rings, that they would shoot in and around Wellington and the studio complex that they'd helped bring to life. And there were slight changes as well, because technology had moved on an awful lot in the decade or so since they'd been filming. And so the kind of things that they would shoot on location in the very windy outdoors, now they could do some more of that indoors on sound stages with green screen in the background. And so that should speed the production up just a little bit. But it's also, Jackson was very wary that this wasn't a straight repeat of Lord of the Rings. This wasn't, as much as it exists in the same world, The Hobbit and the tone of The Hobbit is different to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. In fact, as he would say in Ian Nathan's excellent book, Anything You Can Imagine, Peter Jackson and the Making of Middle-earth, it's not just the dialogue and the characters, it's the actual narrative and the way that Tolkien writes it for a much younger age group. And so he says you get the whole sense of The Hobbit being a children's book. And he said that was a little bit difficult for us to get our heads around. But also, as Jackson would then ultimately lament in behind the scenes materials on the official disc releases, and this was long after he'd actually shot the film as well, he talked about how, because Guillermo del Toro had to leave and I jumped in and took over, we didn't wind the clock back a year and a half and give me a year and a half prep to design the movie, which was different, he said, to the one that del Toro was going to make. And he described the whole experience as impossible, and he said as the result of it being impossible, I just started shooting the movie with most of it not prepped at all. He says you're going onto a set, and this is of a 9-figure film as well, and you're winging it. You've got these massively complicated scenes, you've got no storyboards, and you're making it up there and there on the spot. And it was that thing. It's just like, I wanted Guillermo to have the freedom to do whatever he wanted. And then suddenly he wasn't working on the film anymore. And he just talked about his nerves of that. He just said, am I making this movie? Am I having to inherit everything he did? And he admitted, I hadn't gotten my head into that film. And this in turn extended to the situation with the script that he talked about. Not only did he not really feel on top of the films while he was making them, he was never entirely happy with the screenplays. And it led to a very high pressure situation for Jackson. Now, Lord of the Rings had been high pressure, but they had more in place at the point that he called action for the first time. And whilst Jackson was trying to lighten the mood by screening Buster Keaton films, the cast and crew in the evenings, and there was still the camaraderie amongst the cast and crew, this was turning into quite a complex and difficult film to make, even beyond the complexities they were expecting. Now, he hardly made his job easier by deciding to shoot the film at 48 frames per second, as opposed to the traditional 24 frames a second. Now, this was going to be a new way of shooting films that, in theory, could have the impact on cinema of James Cameron's Avatar and how that reintroduced 3D on a grand scale. Now, 48 frames per second could make film look more real than ever before, but also there's a problem when you're shooting twice as many frames, and the burden of that would, as we're going to explore shortly, fall on Weta to a degree as well. There was a lot of footage to be shot, inevitably, and Jackson was leaning on second unit directors to help him out. He sent an email to Andy Serkis, who was reprising the role of Gollum, reprising his extraordinary performance capture work. Something he admitted he struggled to get back into immediately when he had to inhabit Gollum once more. But Serkis was also going to be doing some second unit work as per the invitation from Jackson. Christian Rivers, who had gone to do Mortal Engines as well for Jackson, he was going to do second unit as well. There was a lot of footage to capture. And also, it was a slightly different experience for some of the actors who'd been around during the Lord of the Rings years as well, because a lot more green screen work this time. Things like the orcs in The Hobbit films are primarily digital, whereas in the Lord of the Rings films, a lot of it lent more on practical work as well. So there was an awful lot going on, and this was making two films at once, remember, as well. The first trailer landed, an announcement trailer it was called, in December 2011, while filming was still happening. And the filming didn't wrap up until well into 2012 as well, the summer of 2012, that the first tranche of filming ahead of pickup shots was completed on the Hobbit films, and the pickups for An Unexpected Journey, as the first one was going to be called, were completed in July 2012 as well. But already by this point, Weta's workload was going through the roof, because it was having to create and integrate digital shots, not just for 24 frames per second, but they had to work across 48 frames per second as well. So straight away, that is a doubling of output, a rendering output required. Also, the red cameras that they were shooting on, the resolution was sharper as well, and so that had to be taken into account. Oh, and just to ice the cake, Jackson was going to release this in 3D too. So all of the digital work that Weta were doing had to have that built into it from the ground up. It would turn inevitably into something of a race to the finish line just to get the movie done. That they were, I mean, this was a very public facing production, that regular videos were going online during the making of the film. And as much as the DVDs of all of the Middle Earth movies are extraordinary for the level of detail they go into behind the scenes, Jackson was opening the door on the shooting of the movie. He was, as it was going along, he was talking about the problems. They were releasing these video blogs that were very, very open about where they were with the film, about how tough things were. And it just opened the door on the fact that they were having to work around the clock to hit the release window that they'd identified for the movie. That, Jackson was cutting the film and putting it together at the Park Road post-production facility located in Wellington. And it was just down to 2 days ahead of the premiere of the movie that they locked down the final shots on it. They also knew, the whole team working on it, that they had to lock down An Unexpected Journey. They would have 3 weeks to go off and promote and release the film. And then in January of 2013, they would be straight back in there to start the whole process again, getting the second film ready for the following year. Now, I do want to acknowledge that just ahead of release as well, there were serious allegations of animal mistreatment that were aimed at the Hobbit films, that Jackson and Warner Brothers issued a statement to vehemently deny the story. stories of that are all out there as well. But they got it complete. The film was done and it was ready to premiere in Wellington in November 2012. This was part of the deal brokered, as I understand it, with the New Zealand government for the legislation going through that they would bring these massive premieres to New Zealand. The film would open wide in New Zealand first as well on the 12th of December 2012. And on the 14th of December 2012, The Hobbit went wide around the world. Now, it was a case of this was a 350 page book that was now spanning multiple movies, because the decision had been made as well during the post-production of An Unexpected Journey to expand it from not just two films to a trilogy of them as well. Now, this would cause problems because the actors' contracts had down that they were going to make two movies, so there's a little bit of negotiation going there. But basically, Jackson walked into Warner Brothers in Los Angeles and just said, look, I was going to do two, can I do three? They looked at the balance sheet, went ka-ching, and said, yeah, of course you can, quite happy. Jackson was also preparing not just the theatrical cut of An Unexpected Journey, that one that debuted running to 169 minutes. He was producing an extended cut again for the disc release, in spite of the fact that DVD was in decline at this point. But the problem really that the film was facing was the response to it just wasn't as strong this time around, that people went in, I think, expecting the Lord of the Rings. And I mean, not to state the obvious, they got The Hobbit. They got something tonally just slightly different as well. And there was quite a lot of pushback on it, that whilst there was a lot of positive reviews and it was hardly slagged off, certainly there was a feeling that it was a bit more bloated, that did it really need such a long running time just to cover the narrative that was covered in the film? And then the 48 frames per second, the high frame rate projection, well, that came in for a particular backlash. Now, New Line had had some warning of this, because even though it hadn't fully previewed the film, it had debuted footage from it to exhibitors the previous spring, so a good like 8 months ahead of release, because it had to prepare the cinema chains for what was coming. And when it did showcase some of that footage, there was just a little bit of pushback on it. It's just like, ooh, not quite sure of this. And as it turned out, when the film did go on to general release, the majority of cinemas projected it at 24 frames per second, that it was converted to accommodate the more traditional frame rate that most of us are used to seeing. The 48 frame problem was it just looked too real. It took away a little bit of the escapism. It looked like it was filmed on admittedly very pleasant, but it looked like it was filmed on a movie set. A very, very good, a very rich movie set, but a movie set not that notwithstanding. The film, I mean, it's hard to come up with a price for the films, just because the overall cost of them was coming close to $1 billion just to make them in the end. So let's just say The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey was costing New Line and MGM in the region of $250 million just for the negative ahead of the marketing and promotion. The box office, though, was stacking up that it opened in America, December the 14th, the 16th, 2012, $84 million. Nice high amount of money, the kind of amount of money that leads Warner Brothers not to cancel its Christmas party. No other major releases dared go against it either. Why would they? I mean, the holdovers were of the top 10 have been around for weeks at that point. DreamWorks' is hugely underrated Rise of the Guardians was on its fourth week of release and in second place. But its 7 million take that weekend was a long way shy of The Hobbit's 84 million. As the saying goes, The Hobbit wasn't just number one, it was number one by a very long way. Lincoln was around on week six. That had just cost 100 million in the US. But the hit of the season to that point had been the James Bond film, Skyfall. Ironically, another film delayed and caught up in the MGM financing issues. That was up to near $300 million, had been around for 6 weeks, and was in fourth place on the chart. Looking down the chart, your Life of Pi in there, Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 2, Wreck-It Ralph, Red Dawn as well, further irony there, and Silver Linings Playbook. The Hobbit's second week takings held reasonably well, down 56%, a 36 million second weekend in the States alone, and Warner Brothers again happy with another chart topping week as Jack Reacher came along, This Is 40 came along, The Guilt Trip was out as well, and even as competition arrived over Christmas with the likes of Django Unchained and Les Miserables and Parental Guidance, The Hobbit was holding firm at the top of the chart, and it wouldn't surrender that until early January, when the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre film popped along. So The Hobbit grossed in the end in the US $300 million and outside of the US $714 million. So $1 billion grossing film, albeit one that had left some elements of the fan base a little bit disappointed. That said, Warner Brothers perfectly happy with $1 billion in the bank. And then it was on to, well, first of all, dealing with a couple of legalities that that Warner Brothers and the estate of J.R.R. Tolkien found themselves in various degrees of disagreement. But then it was putting the DVD releases of The Hobbit out there and moving on to the second of what were now three films. But I think we'll come to the further films in another episode of the podcast. And that brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you for listening and thank you for your time. It's parish notice time, and heck, we've been a bit busy. Two new issues of our magazines are now on sale. So Film Stories issue 43 has the behind the scenes story of the summer blockbuster Greatest Days, based in and around the music of Take That. That goes on sale very, very shortly. It is a jam-packed issue with all sorts of film mayhem in there, lots of new film writing as well. And Film Junior, a print magazine for under 15s, primarily written by them as well, that has also gone on sale. That one leads with an interview conducted by young writers as well, young reporters, with the directors of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And that is just, I'm really, really proud of those magazines. You can find them at store.filmstories.co.uk, and please help spread the word. That kind of thing is hugely appreciated. If you like this podcast, there are three ways you can really support it. The first, financially, if you go to patreon.com/simonbrew, if you put some money in the pot there, then you get an ad-free version of this podcast. You tend to get it early as well. You find out the gossip of what we're up to behind the scenes. We're pretty busy there as well at the moment with an abundance of projects we're trying to juggle. Costing you absolutely nothing is just subscribe to this podcast to your home of choice. That really helps with algorithms and posh things that I don't understand, as does ideally leaving a hugely positive review too. If you'd be kind enough to do that, that is much appreciated. It is the lifeblood of independent podcasts. One more thing too, I'm live again. I'm doing one more live show this side of the summer here in the UK, and it is on the 1st of June 2023. I'm at King's Place in London, where I'm bringing my Movie Geek live show. My special guest is Sarah Smith, the director of films such as Arthur Christmas and Ron's Gone Wrong, and we're going to get to the bottom of her story at the event there in person as well. If you go to filmstories.co.uk, click on the live events tab at the top of the page, you'll find all the ticket information and details of when shows are as well. Any upcoming shows we'll add there. But I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. I think we're done with parish notices. Let's do a bit of animation. Let's go back to the back end of the 1990s and, well, I'll play you a clip from the trailer. Come to the story the other side of this.
Beneath our feet lies another world.
Why'd I have to be born a worker?
In case you haven't noticed, we ants are running this show. We're the lords of the earth.
A world just like our own.
Okay, everybody, 6:15, time to dance.
Don't you want your 8-bit beer?
Call me crazy, but I have a thing about drinking from the caboose of another creature.
Suit yourself.
Z was just another face in the crowd, until the day she came into his life.
Hi. Want to dance?
Absolutely.
What on earth are you doing?
You know, why does everybody have to dance the same way? You know, that's completely boring.
It's no fun.
Princess Bala, the guards are coming!
You're a princess. When can I see you again?
Never. Bye.
No, wait. Weaver, you gotta switch places with me. This is the only way I can see Princess Bala.
Oh, boy.
Princess Bala! Princess Bala! Hey, it's me!
Right, Percy!
We received word that the termite enemy has mobilized.
This guy's crazy.
I am proud to send you into battle.
I'm sorry, into battle?
And that is a clip from 1998's animated movie Ants, directed by Eric Darnell and Tim Johnson, screenplay credited to Todd Olcott, Chris Weitz, Paul Weitz, and a voice cast including Woody Allen, Dan Aykroyd, Sylvester Stallone, Anne Bancroft, Danny Glover, Gene Hackman, Jennifer Lopez, Paul Mazursky, Sharon Stone, and Christopher Walken. So the story of Ants is kind of embroiled, really, in a bit of a corporate story as well. That had history actually played out, the first film from a company called DreamWorks Animation, you might have heard of them, wouldn't actually have been Ants. Instead, its first animated production was going to be The Prince of Egypt, that the main DreamWorks studio would debut The Peacemaker as its first movie. But for the much-hyped animation arm, I mean, the hand-drawn film The Prince of Egypt was due to go first. But there was a reason for the switch that would happen, a fairly contentious switch, as it turned out as well. So if we just go back into the history of DreamWorks, the company DreamWorks SKG, as it was known, was formed by Jeffrey Katzenberg, formerly heading up movies at Disney, Steven Spielberg, you might have heard of him, and David Geffen, record producer, movie producer, billionaire kind of person with a spare few quid. And so of that partnership in particular, because he hadn't brought so much of the finance, Jeffrey Katzenberg had much to prove, that he'd overseen live action movies at Disney throughout the early 1990s in particular, and was also a key component in the resurgence of Disney animation as well. And so what happened at the top of Disney, and James B. Stewart's book Disney War explores this in great detail, is there was a power struggle at the top of the company. This was caused by the unexpected death of Frank Wells, who had been president of the Walt Disney Company from 1984. He died in an accident in 1994, and that left both Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner thinking, well, his job should be theirs. This was heavily reported in the trade press at the time, but in a power battle, it was Eisner who prevailed, and Katzenberg was left feeling that he'd been sold short and decided to up sticks from Disney and become a key component of the DreamWorks enterprise instead. Now, at the point Katzenberg left in the mid-1990s, well, Disney had projects that were already underway. The Lion King came out in 94. Films such as The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Pocahontas were on their way through the system. And also, Katzenberg had been instrumental in giving Pixar's first digitally animated feature, Toy Story, the green light. And in fact, talk had already begun about what its second film would be, a film that would ultimately go on to be called A Bug's Life. But also going back into the history of Disney, in the late 1980s, a pitch had been circling for an animated film called Army Ants as well. So there were lots of potential inspirations for the film that we're actually discussing here, Ants. So Katzenberg duly got to his new office at DreamWorks and started moving along projects that he tried to get going previously during his time at Disney. So he kick-started hand-drawn animated films such as The Prince of Egypt and Sinbad. Now, it was in the summer of 1994 when over at Pixar, Joe Ranft and Andrew Stanton pitched what would become A Bug's Life. Now, Katzenberg would say he never got to hear this pitch. I don't think that's massively contested either. But with Toy Story, move forward a year with Toy Story on the eve of release, such was the friendly cordial relations between Katzenberg and the Pixar team, even though he'd gone from Disney to DreamWorks. Well, Pixar's John Lasseter and Andrew Stanton went to the DreamWorks office and had a very open conversation with Katzenberg that was reported in a major piece over at Business Week magazine. And during that conversation, Stanton and Lasseter got talking about this film they had, A Bug's Life. Now, by this stage, an executive called Nina Jacobson, who'd previously been at Disney but had made the move over to DreamWorks as well, she'd pitched the idea for a film that would become Ants, and that was added to the roster. And digging back to that Business Week report, Lasseter talked in that about he should have seen trouble coming, because Bugs, as A Bug's Life was known at that point, well, Katzenberg seemed really quite interested in it, and as the report wrote, Katzenberg seemed to do some calculations in his head and asked when it would be released. Lasseter said probably in the Thanksgiving of 1998, towards the end of the year, and Katzenberg would say, oh, that's when The Prince of Egypt is coming out. But there was this other project, Ants, that was also in Katzenberg's head, and the Bugs project seemed really quite close in tone, or at least in subject matter, to it. So Ants, it became clear, was going to need computer animation to bring the scale of it required to the screen. One of the ongoing jokes about Ants, or certainly the scene setting of it, is there are lots of ants, and hand drawing all of those looked like really hard work. Not that computers made it that much easier in the end. But let's turn to a company called Pacific Data Images, PDI, friendly with Pixar actually, used to hold lots of joint events together. They've been around since 1980, but just as with Pixar, it got to the point of the early 1990s, and it was moving towards the idea of a fully digitally animated feature film. Now, it had done some notable digital animation already, an episode of The Simpsons where it all went 3D. That was handed over to PDI, and PDI managed to realise that. But come 1995, PDI and DreamWorks had a common cause, and a deal was struck that would see Ants become their first collaboration. This was a film that was going to be out in the spring of 1999, and Larry Guterman, Tim Johnson and Eric Darnell were brought aboard to direct. And word of the movie made its way to the Hollywood trade press as well, which is where some of the Pixar team were just like, oh, that certainly looks a little bit familiar. So let's jump back to that Business Week article, because as it reported, and I'm quoting it here, sometime later, Pixar learned it had been what it described as betrayed. This is the words of John Lasseter. Pixar sources say PDI chief Carl Rosendahl set up a lunch with Lasseter to tell him some news that was weighing on him, that Katzenberg had agreed to do the deal with PDI, but only on the condition that PDI committed to deliver the film Ants before Bugs came out. Now, neither Lasseter nor Rosendahl went on record in that report, but this was the first sign of something that was going to play out in public just a couple of years down the line as well. And Lasseter talked about how he smelt something of a rat when he started reading about the Ants project, and when he realised quite what had happened and what was happening, he did call Jeffrey Katzenberg up. And the report says, Lasseter asked him, "Jeffrey, how could you?" And he claimed Katzenberg, quote, hemmed and hawed, and then admitted he was making Ants. And so Lasseter is quoted by Business Week as saying he started talking about all of this paranoid stuff about conspiracies that Disney was out to get him and he had to do something. And Lasseter said, "That's when I realised it wasn't about me. Pixar was just cannon fodder in his fight with Disney." Because Disney wasn't taking the idea of Ants lying down. It certainly wasn't taking the threat of DreamWorks lying down. DreamWorks had announced this big end of 1998 release for The Prince of Egypt. It was a big flagship release for the company, a statement of intent. And Disney had promptly scheduled A Bug's Life against it on exactly the same weekend. The whole idea of, let's just swat this new competitor out of place if we can. And Katzenberg knew he needed to make a mark. And so a part and parcel of the deal he struck with PDI, which saw DreamWorks take a 40% stake in the company, would eventually acquire it entire, was the need to get this film made quickly. That even though it's playing out in public that Ants was targeted for 1999, Katzenberg knew he had to get to the screen first. It had to land before A Bug's Life. And it would be very late in the day that Katzenberg had the audacity, as was quoted by James B. Stewart in Disney War, to move the release date for Ants ahead of A Bug's Life. But let's move on to the production a little bit, because talking about the filmmakers on the movie, I mean, the practicalities of making the film were quite pronounced, and co-director Tim Johnson absolutely knew this as well, that he would talk about just the fact that Ants only live for 8 weeks for a start, and he knew that all references within the film had to be, in his words, keyed to that. As he told Entertainment Weekly, "We didn't quite stick to the exact maths of it, but it was always part of our thinking." And he said, "Plus, if you have something like a shoe going by at normal speed, it might look huge, but you wouldn't feel it as huge. So the audience has to believe that the other world out there is really big." And this was some quite complex design work that was going on. But also, not unlike the Hobbit story we've just gone through, the production time on the film was a little bit more truncated than ideally it would have been. Because PDI was, first of all, I mean, it was its first full-length digital feature, and it was pathfinding how to get a digital movie made. It was also designing everything, but because of the overhanging release date change that was impending, it just had 2.5 years to get this done from start to finish. And just like character design work on the lead character alone was 10 months of design work for one particular team to get it right. But right the way through, I mean, Katzenberg and the DreamWorks team were keeping their cards pretty close to their chest, that in May 1998, DreamWorks was saying the film couldn't be ready until the following year. But fairly soon, and again, fairly late in the day, it switched that release date to October the 2nd, which was now 7 weeks ahead of A Bug's Life, widely seen in Hollywood as being something like a spoiler move, really, to basically mark out its territory, that if you've got two films going head to head of similar subject matter, you want to be the one out first. Now, DreamWorks' Jeffrey Katzenberg would tell Entertainment Weekly that it wasn't a consideration, the idea of moving ahead of Disney. Yeah, right. He just said, we looked at a spokesperson for DreamWorks, is quoted as saying, we looked at the fall schedule and saw there was a perfect window for it, and the two films are really very different, which is actually true. Tonally, I think they are quite different as well. So while that was playing out in the boardrooms, well, the voice casting had really been getting underway, and Katzenberg really dug into his Disney playbook here, that following 1992's Aladdin, where Robin Williams's performance had really supercharged the film, Disney had been leaning more and more towards star names for its animated movies, and this was a policy that Katzenberg was very much bringing across to DreamWorks as well. So he got on the phone to an old contact of his, Woody Allen, who took a call and agreed to voice the character of Z. As Patty Wooten, the producer on the film, said, the first time we took the script to New York to show it to Woody, he was amazed at how much it sounded like him. He said, somebody knows me very well. Alan would do 5 days of voice recording in the end, which he would reportedly absolutely hate. He did a bit of script tweaking as well, and he would never make an animated movie again, just because he just didn't really enjoy the experience of it. The final script actually in the end was part credited to the Weitz brothers, Paul and Chris. I'll come to them shortly, but this was like a year ahead of American Pie coming out, which would really firmly put them on the map. And Todd Acklot as well was also credited with the script. One person who also joined the project in a voicing role was Sarah Jessica Parker as Princess Bala, the love interest for the character of Z. Sarah Jessica Parker recorded quite a lot of work for this. She did a couple of days of voice recording for it, but eventually the filmmakers decided to go in a different direction, and she was replaced by Sharon Stone, who came in and re-recorded all the work. Christopher Walker, meanwhile, was seen to be doing such strong work with his voice performance on the film that the role that he was earmarked for would be expanded to accommodate that. For the part of Weaver, Arnold Schwarzenegger, they wanted a big action star. Arnold Schwarzenegger seemed ideal for that. He was rumoured to have been offered the voice role and his agents put in a quote. And the story goes that Sylvester Stallone basically undercut him to get the part, and it would be Stallone whose voice you hear in the film as well. Gene Hackman came aboard as well. A really extensive voice star, a collection of voice stars. And this also informed the look of the design of the movie, that the decision was made that they would lean the character designs towards the people who were actually playing the characters, that Rex Grignon, who was one of the pair of supervising animators on it, would just talk about, we're half thinking it'd be wonderful if one of our characters got nominated for an acting award, because really we're measuring ourselves against live action rather than conventional animation. He relayed this to the Los Angeles Times, and when people saw the character designs, it was clear that the real reference stuff was the stuff they were leaning heavily into. Now, it was still up against this really tight production schedule, and it got to the point where Katzenberg reportedly offered cash bonuses to the PDI team to be able to hit the final deadline and get the movie made and in cinemas on time. He would deploy a similar tactic with Aardman Animations on Chicken Run, which came out in 2000, where he offered to take the entire Aardman team out for a huge dinner if they got the film completed on time. Both tactics worked in this case. But, I mean, just to dig into just some of the technicalities they were playing with. I mean, the crowd scenes in Ants, and this was a point where people weren't making digital animated feature films at the point they embarked on this. It was just Pixar and PDI were the two big outliers, certainly for films of this scale. And so they had crowd scenes with 80,000 characters at once that all had to be rendered. There were hundreds of shots with lots and lots of people in there. They had to have custom-made crowd simulation software that they had to come up with just to be able to get across what they wanted to put on screen. While they were rushing to the finish line as well, a trailer came out in December 1997, giving the impression that all was in far better shape than it was, but PDI was galloping to the finish line. And as Chris Weitz would reflect to the Huffington Post many years later, he said, we just didn't know, actually, there was that much of a race until late in the process, when it turned out there'd been what he described as a fake schedule, that they hadn't really been told that they were trying to get ahead of A Bug's Life until fairly late in the day. And White said, we'd been working on this accelerated pace without really knowing exactly why. He said, we knew that we were cranking it out because there was just a general sense of rush. And he also described how making an animated film is very labour intensive, that everything goes through this kind of brutal process in storyboarding, animatics, back to script. You go through that over and over again. And he said of Katzenberg that he was a very good but exacting boss, and described the environment of making the film as high pressure and high intensity, with the script keeping changing as actors change, as gags change, lots and lots of writing needed to be done right the way through the production of the film. Now, when it came to the actual box office itself, then Disney, I mean, it opted to barely mention ants in the publicity for it. And both companies suddenly got really quite coy. I mean, the most you get from Disney was that its chairman at the time, Joe Roth, said they're totally different movies. They're not even comparable, he said to the Los Angeles Times. Lasseter was said to have had slightly less savoury things to say about ants. But still, it got into cinemas. In fact, it debuted at the Toronto International Film Festival on September the 19th, 1998, ahead of its cinema release on October the 2nd, 1998. And the reception for it was really quite good. That it was noted that this skewed to a slightly older audience. It was PG rated, which animated films generally weren't. I should note that Hans Zimmer was sounded out about doing the score, but he was knee deep in finishing The Prince of Egypt. And so he recommended Harry Gregson-Williams and John Powell to do the score instead. I really loved the score to Ants a lot. But the reception to the film, I mean, the critical response to it was good. Not great, but really, I'd say very good even, that the animation was doing things that hadn't been seen on screen at that point. So we were still very much in the novelty era of CG. But it was funny that the fact that it was skewing older was very much in its favour. And while the critical response wasn't quite as good as Pixar would enjoy for its younger skewing of Bug's Life, well, DreamWorks could be pretty happy with what it had got here. It got a film out on time that has been really well received. A budget said to be in the region of $40 to $50 million as well. It hadn't been the most expensive movie to make. And it opened at number one at the box office start of October 1998. That new release date worked. $17 million opening weekend, holding off a challenge from the Robin Williams headline What Dreams May Come, which had $15 million, knocking Rush Hour, the first Rush Hour film, off the top of the chart. And A Night at the Roxbury was the other opener that week. That didn't crack $10 million for Paramount Pictures. Ronin was around, Urban Legend was around. There just wasn't much in the way of family films that would rival Ants, but then it was hardly school holiday time either. So as it turned out, the release date they'd staked out proved to be quite a clever one, because even in its second week, it only lost 14% of its business, held the number one spot as the Eddie Murphy headlined Holy Man only just cracked the top five as the biggest new opener. And it wasn't until the Halloween movies came along in the middle of October, that would be Practical Magic and Bride of Chucky, that Ants found itself down in third place, but still doing comfortably pleasant amounts of money. It would hang around actually in the top five for many, many more weeks. And wouldn't you know it, it wasn't until A Bug's Life was gearing up that Ants finally was looking to drop out of the top 10. In fact, A Bug's Life would open initially on a limited number of screens, but it went wide at the end of November 1998, by which time that was the point that Ants finally dropped out the top 10. It had grossed $85 million in the US by that point. A Bug's Life would go on to make more money. However, Ants would turn in a tidy profit for DreamWorks. $90 million in the US in the end by the time its run had fully completed. $81 million outside of the US. A worldwide take of $171 million as well. And also, it had opened up this path to getting digitally animated films made at DreamWorks, which would be its lifeblood for a significant amount of time down the road. It would go on to acquire the entirety of PDI, and PDI would have a sad end actually, because when the 2014 movie The Penguins of Madagascar didn't perform at the box office, DreamWorks restructured its company dramatically, and in 2015 one victim of that was PDI, which was fully shut down and completely didn't come back, and its run of several decades was just gone as a result of DreamWorks' poor box office run, which led to an entire restructure and an eventual sale of the company as well. One further note, actually, Ants wasn't particularly served by home media releases either. The DVD was good. That came out, sold lots of copies. We didn't actually even get a Blu-ray of it, though, until 2018. I do recommend checking it out if you haven't. I mean, it obviously looks dated quite a lot now. The animation certainly does. The score remains great. The ideas in it remain really interesting. The fact that they managed to do so much pathfinding and deliver a film in 2.5 years, I still think is really, really quite remarkable. A film well worth basically not forgetting about. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you for your time and thank you for listening and for tolerating me for so long. If you're not completely bored, you can find more from me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find more from the entire Film Stories project at Film Stories. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, youtube.com/filmstories. Our website is filmstories.co.uk. That's updated every weekday with movie news and reviews and features and things like that. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that's where you'll find all of our print magazines, over 50 of them now. You'll find our Blu-ray of Sneakers as well, more Blu-rays on the way too, and the Patreon again is patreon.com/simonbrew. But I think that's it. Thank you as always for your time. Thank you for listening. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. As always, until then, the most important thing is you all stay well and you all stay healthy. Take care. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.